If, as our panelists unload, today's program seems a bit one-sided, don't blame us. Perhaps I should start out by introducing the people we asked who will not be here. Herb Klein, the President's Director of Communications, is not here. He could not be, of course, because he is with the President, communicating to the Russians. Pat Buchanan, the White House man on the networks, is not here. Dean Burtz, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, is not here. We had asked them to come help our press panelists tackle this tough topic of conversation today, the administration and the media. The very title of the program underlines the concept that ours is an adversary relationship. That certainly seems to be the feeling of some administration leaders. I personally disagree with those on the press side who also keep talking as if we are always and forever adversaries of our own government, its people, and its machinery. I'd rather believe that our task in relation to news of government at all levels is not much different than the responsibilities we have in any area of news gathering and giving, and that is to find out what's up and to put it down on newsprint or out over the airwaves so that all of us know what's going on. I don't mean by this that the battle to level the barricades of secrecy and censorship is anywhere near ended, but I do get just as unhappy about sloppy or biased or irresponsible practitioners of our craft as I do about naysayers from without. Their output feeds the anti-press diatribes of the autocrat and the crook and the corrupt and shakes the faith of our readers and listeners. We've had pluses and minuses in recent years in the battle for freedom of information. The bar supposedly imposed its Reardon muzzle on the administration of justice, but not without any real effect. Our classification-crazy bureaucrats have had a few notable comeuppances. We finally got the whole news out of Attica. We've got several New York Times landmark precedents from the Supreme Court. We've got a freedom of information law from Congress that's proved so imposing a threat that we're facing some criticism for not going to court enough. But we've still got a long way to go. Perhaps the biggest immediate hurdle is right here on the Hill, where they're all for the executive branch opening up, but are violating the hell out of a Legislative Reorganization Act of 1970. The House Appropriations Committee last year held 92% of its sessions behind closed doors. And Bill Fulbright, of all people, slammed the Foreign Relations Committee portals in the face of the public 45% of the time in 1971. And now our panel, I hope, will go into some of these in these fields in greater detail. We're in the familiar position of leadoff batter. We offer up Bill Monroe. The Washington editor of the Today Show, which serves as an alarm clock for a lot of you lucky liabeds who don't have to get up and go to work, as some of us do, before 6 a.m. Bill has been covering and uncovering politicians for 30 years. As a freelancer, as a UPI staffer, and as a longtime radio and TV newsman and news executive. Before he began serving up interviews to you at the breakfast table, he headed NBC's Washington News Bureau for almost 8 years. In addition to their good looks and microphone voices and middle age, Bill Monroe and Warren Rogers share one other jazzy quality. They both have outgrown New Orleans.
Thank you, Dave. Before I begin, I've got to say one word on behalf of a guest who is not here, who was invited, and that is Dean Burtz. I'm sort of glad he's not here. It seems to me, as head of the FCC, perhaps he should not be here participating in a discussion of the administration and the media, and maybe he's got a good reason on principle not to be here. As far as the others are concerned, with the possible exception of Herb Klein, I think they should all have accepted. I'm going to engage in the comfort of a text because I can get more into 10 minutes when it's written, also because I know what can happen to those who are ill-prepared. Some time ago in Louisiana, there were reports that a man upstate an automobile dealer named Fred P-R-E-A-U-S, was about to announce for governor. At the New Orleans television station where I worked, we were calling the man Fred Pro. On the morning he finally made his official announcement, the AP story took special note of how to pronounce his name. And this being back in the days when announcers were reading news, one of the station's golden voices, reading copy he had not looked over in advance, told his audience, "Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. There's a new candidate for governor this morning. The new candidate is Fred Pro, whose name rhymes with moose." I'd like first to touch on what I look on as a long-range threat to press freedom, a threat going back beyond the present administration, back half a century, to the establishment of a kind of regulation that wipes out the First Amendment for broadcasting. It started because somebody had to tell broadcasters, you operate on this channel, you operate on that channel. That much regulation, the simple allocation of channels, was all that was necessary. And that much regulation does not cut across the First Amendment. It does not of itself, or would not, make the electronic media accountable to government. But we didn't stop there. One reason we didn't stop there was that in the early days of radio, and later in the early days of television, it was not clear what these media were. Actually, a new form of press. Today, it is clear. Radio and television perform the same basic function of informing the public that newspapers and magazines do. Neither the prime time entertainment nor the Sunday color comics dilutes that point. Senator Sam Ervin has said that the writers of the First Amendment would certainly have included television in it specifically had television been around in those days. So we have now developed an important form of press that is unfree and becoming less free as license challenges, fairness complaints from a federal agency, and guidelines on political coverage emanating directly from Congress and sometimes indirectly from the White House, as all these things multiply. This kind of regulation, it seems to me, is a desperate mistake. It can be changed. It is anti-First Amendment. It is un-American by the standards of 1776. If it has become American by the standards of 1976, we're in trouble. Increasingly, broadcasters are entangled with government. They look over their shoulders apprehensively at Congress and the regulators. They consult their lawyers about tackling controversial subjects. They respond to 200 letters a year from the FCC, letters demanding justification to a government agency of a particular program or of particular coverage accused of unfairness. Compared to this danger to press freedom, the dangers author Ox Sulzberger addressed himself to the other day, it seems to me, are peanuts. Particularly if the newspapers got interested in it, this kind of regulation could eventually be turned around. The technical allocation of channels would remain, but the accountability to government for editorial decisions could be stripped away. It could be done by granting licenses in perpetuity and by eliminating such sinister absurdities as setting up 7 presidential appointees to referee fairness and balance in the media. If it sounds radical, and it does to most people because we have drifted into a lazy, blind consensus on this subject, it is exactly as radical and as sound as the system of free press which we still apply, fortunately, to newspapers. I wish I had 30 or 60 minutes to elaborate on this subject, but I don't. If anybody is interested, and if you'll give me your name and address on a slip of paper or call me at NBC, I'll be glad to provide elaboration in documentary form rather than through your ear. At any rate, that long-range and growing oppression of broadcasting, coming more from liberal democratic regulators than any other single source, makes the electronic media vulnerable and sensitive. And the present administration sometimes seems quite willing to play on this vulnerability in their guerrilla warfare against the media. The attitude behind this warfare obviously goes beyond the normal irritation of men in power over the independence of the media, beyond the normal yen to control the media, beyond the old feeling on the part of incumbents that the press's job is to serve the government and that it's doing a lousy job of it. I've mentioned that, in my view, broadcasting is not as independent as it ought to be and could be, not as independent as the printed press. But it was clear in Vice President Agnew's original attack on the networks that broadcasting is too independent to suit him. It's worth remembering that he did not simply criticize network news policies, as he has, it seems to me, every right to do. He specifically mentioned that broadcasting was licensed by government, and he talked about making it responsible to the public will if it didn't shape up. He brought up the matter of what he called instant analysis and challenged the very right of broadcast journalists to engage in it. He did not use names, but I'll supply some specifics he omitted. In a Vietnam speech, President Nixon had characterized a letter to him from Ho Chi Minh as being hard line. Marvin Kalb of CBS came on afterwards and said that some experts, these are not his exact words, that some experts interpreted that letter differently. Mr. Agnew said, in effect, that Marvin Kalb had no business saying that immediately after the president had been on the air. So network presidents answered back, as they should have, not so much because their news departments were criticized, but because the number two man in the administration seemed quite clearly to be questioning their basic right to practice independent journalism. After the vice president spoke, half a dozen top administration spokesmen chimed in with amens. It had the kind of nice orchestration that normally derives from a skillful conductor. The guerrilla warfare had begun. Today, the beat goes on. Herb Klein knocks the media. Ken Clawson does it. Jim Keogh writes a book about the media mistreatment of the president just in time for the campaign. This cabinet member gets into the act, that senator. The Republican committee paper Monday takes the book called The News Twisters by Edith Efron, a piece of journalistic pornography, and treats it as God's truth. The yen to control, the hostility toward independent or critical journalism, finds expression in an official White House position against what Tom Whitehead has called a fourth network. The folks at the White House don't exactly want to eliminate the idea of a public television network. They just want to make sure it is dominated by local stations, and they want it generally to keep out of news and public affairs. They want it to stick to Ibsen and Beethoven and Sesame Street. Mr. Whitehead, the White House man in charge of structuring broadcasting, much as Herb Klein is in charge of programming it, has declared himself against the idea of news competition for the commercial networks, against the idea of more information sources for the American people, against the idea of more public affairs programs in prime time on the public network. In fairness, it should be stated that public television has occasionally put on a few works of hairy-chested advocate producers, works calculated to outrage the White House and whose balance of viewpoints was precarious at best. And it invited political kickback by hiring Sander Van Oker at exactly twice the salary of a senator. But the telling thing to me is the administration's mode of fighting back. Squelch, suppress, strangle, stop a fourth national network strong on news. Keep appropriations for public television low and tied to one-year renewals. The Congress, happily, has not bought the idea of putting news off limits to the public television network. But that idea comes naturally out of what seems to me to be the administration's media policy. Maximize government pressure, minimize media independence. It fits the pattern of Herb Klein's Ministry of Information with its sticks and carrots for the media. It fits the pattern of a president communicating to the people via speeches, in other words, controlled appearances, and the abandonment of news conferences where newsmen can inject the distasteful and the unexpected. Well, what do we in the media do about all this? I think we avoid the temptation, if possible, to wage guerrilla warfare in return on an automatic, unthinking basis. Some of what the administration is doing is like what other administrations have done. By comparison with the Johnsonites, the Nixonites are just taking their impatience with the media and their urge to control a step further, organizing them better. Some of the administration's argument is legitimate. Mixed in with the stink bombs, there is some honest criticism. We make mistakes, most out of haste and carelessness, and some out of bias, and they have a right to call us on them. They even have a right to campaign against us if they feel like it. Huey Long and Franklin Roosevelt did it long ago. But when we get the feeling that they're trying to manipulate journalism, pressuring, using government muscle, testing the independence of journalists, that's something else. This is our time to say no, to talk back, to counterattack, to raise questions with readers and viewers about what government is up to. Some of you gentlemen of print have come to the defense of broadcasting in specific cases when its journalistic integrity was challenged and it has made a difference. I hope that you will have occasion to consider and defend the long-range need of broadcasting for full First Amendment freedom, not for the sake of broadcasters, but for the sake of a continuing, clean, uncontaminated flow of information in this country. Curiously enough, broadcasting, perhaps because of the chill twilight of regulation in which it exists, is not much inclined to make its own case via its own media for genuine First Amendment status. So it may be that the case will never be made where millions of people can examine it unless it is made by print. I'm not personally satisfied with broadcasting's reticence in this respect, but there are problems. There are inevitably inhibitions which ought not to exist but do exist, inhibitions that publishers do not and need not feel. At the same time, in regard to print, I wonder whether the newspapers, if they do not eventually understand and make the case for broadcasting as free press, will not lose their own souls and down the road their own security under the First Amendment. Our problems with this administration are not easy, but they will pass. The real problem, I think, is whether over the next 50 years, all of us, broadcasters, newspapermen, intellectuals, congressmen, lawyers, judges, and citizens who want credible news, recognize broadcasting as First Amendment press, or whether we allow it to become what it is slowly becoming, what this administration and the ones to follow would like it to become, a tool of the White House.
We do invite sticks and carrots from the audience if anybody wants to take advantage of the question cards on your table and pass them up. And now it's the pencil press's turn at bat. Long before Edmund Diamond, whoever he is, came along, and Spiro Agnew became a household word, and for that matter, long before anyone ever dreamed up the fancy phrase media critic, a veteran newspaper man named Ben H. Bagdikian was aiming sharp and articulate needles at both the Achilles heels and the plain old regular heels of journalism. I doubt very much whether he'd ever be elected Man of the Year in some newspaper circles. Some of our colleagues might, however, settle for Nag of the Year. In a word, he's been damn good for our trade, which ordinarily shuns naval-looking, which is more than I can say for Henry Kissinger these days. The Washington Post a few years ago decided to let Ben put up or shut up and hired him away from a Rand Corporation think tank where he'd settled after learning our craft as a contributing editor of the Saturday Evening Post, and look what happened to that, and as a foreign and Washington correspondent for the Providence Journal. He's alternated at the Washington Post from resident ombudsman to national news editor and back to House Nag again. Last Sunday, perhaps in a warm-up for today, he raised hell on the editorial page about his paper, his profession, and Mr. Nixon's flax. In other words, about the administration and the media. Ben?
I'm reading from a top-secret document, and what I'm about to say is on deep, deep background. However, if it should be wildly acclaimed at the end, you may consider it automatically declassified. A lot of you know the little joke Nikita Khrushchev told on himself when he and John Kennedy met in Vienna in 1961. Khrushchev said that a Soviet citizen ran around the Kremlin yelling, "Khrushchev is crazy, Khrushchev is crazy." The man was arrested, brought before a tribunal, and was sentenced to 23 years at hard labor. Khrushchev explained, he got 3 years for defaming the chairman of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the USSR and 20 years for revealing a state secret. Now, that story comes to mind easily during much of the government's legal and verbal attacks on the press. We're told that we endanger national security by printing classified information, although even the government's own experts say that most classified information ought to be open. During the Pentagon Papers court case, a State Department official testified on the terrible danger of the publication of those papers. That same official, shortly thereafter, testified in before a congressional committee that of the 7,000 pages of the Pentagon Papers, at least 6,000 should not be classified. William Florence, who for 28 years was in classification in the Department of Defense, says at least 99.5% of secret documents should not be secret. And most of the remainder doesn't so much protect the security of the United States as protect some of its officials from embarrassment. In Washington today, protection of a public agency or a public official from embarrassment has reached the sanctity of a state secret. Yet for all the talk about irresponsible printing of secrets, secrecy is a governmental disease that has almost certainly hurt the country more than disclosure of secrets. It's always easy to predict disaster if something is printed, especially if you succeed in keeping it secret, since you can then never tell what would have happened. We were told that publishing the Pentagon Papers would endanger important diplomatic negotiations. A warning followed thereafter by negotiations of a kind never before done with China and Russia. We forget that more mistakes, including some catastrophic ones, have been made for a lack of information than from unwise disclosure. In the equation of secrecy, the cost of bottling up information from those who should be acting on it is never mentioned. Nevertheless, we hear with increasing stridency that the press, by printing what it learns, is giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Now, this is familiar language, at least to those who remember Joseph McCarthy. The public officials accusing the press of printing things harmful to the country ought to go back to their microfilms. I was going to suggest that they ought to go back to the First Amendment, but maybe that's too arcane. Let them go back to the microfilms of papers of the late 1940s and early 1950s, when a young member of Congress named Richard Nixon was attacking those who suggested negotiations with the Russians or recognition of the government of mainland China. Some loyal civil servants were destroyed as a result, and this country lost some much-needed experts during 20 crucial years of the Cold War, ruined by accusations or implications of treason or stupidity for proposing an unpopular, unofficial idea, or even for analyzing it. So who was right? If it is better to negotiate from a position of strength, who served the interests of the United States best? Those who wanted to try negotiations 20 years ago before the Russians had their H-bomb and the Chinese their A-bomb, or those who decided to wait 20 years until both Russia and China are incomparably more powerful than they were? The important answer is that at any given time, no one can be sure. So free expression is essential. Today, when it comes to justifying his trips to China and Russia, Mr. Nixon's biggest political problem at home are the people who believed him 20 years ago and don't agree with him now that he's reversed himself. Now, there's no reason why Mr. Nixon should not change his mind. Everyone should be free to do that. The point is that being open to new ideas, unconventional information, and opposition thoughts is how we readjust our thinking to match changing realities, and this all depends on the right to speak freely and the right of a free press and free expression. It is the existence of these rights and the respect in which they are held that permits the president the freedom to change his mind when he thinks it's best for the country. That kind of openness and freedom is where the strength of this country comes from, not secrecy and rigidity that forces us to pursue bad policies no matter how disastrous they are proven to be. The real problem, I think, of America ending the war in Indochina is the years in which our leaders insisted that it was wrong and disloyal to even talk about it. It's about time that the government and a lot of other people learned to lay off the nonsense about aiding enemies by publishing true and significant information, or implying disloyalty and irresponsibility every time a journalist reports a piece of reality the government wished didn't exist. The best aid the enemies of this country could have is a subservient press that didn't unearth errors or that hesitated to oppose official views. The government and the press never got along very well from the beginning of the Republic, nor should we expect a love feast in a healthy democracy, especially one that is changing and needs the greatest exposure to ideas and the largest number of remedies talked about. But some things make the present attacks more serious. First, there's the legal action for suppression, as in the Pentagon Papers case, and the continuing FBI inquiries about journalists. Then there's the propagation by the Vice President and others that with the idea that the American press is biased against the Nixon administration and the political values of the country and the country at large. I think this is one of the most successful con games of our time. The fact is that the press of this country is overwhelmingly conservative and Republican. We are in danger of not enough criticism of government, not too much. Most of the news that leaves this town is pretty much what public officials say, with not enough time and energy put into testing the validity of what they say. It's only human that a public official wants it that way, but it happens to be lousy journalism and bad for democracy. Now, Democrats weren't in love with the press either in their time, and we shouldn't expect to be loved. We dish it out, and we ought to be able to take it when it's given back to us. But when it comes to the press, I think there's a difference between Republicans and Democrats. The Republicans have had a sympathetic press for so long in so many places that they now regard any departure from this as a theft of a natural right. Now, it's not really the Republicans' fault either. It's the fault of the majority of papers in this country who have conditioned their local conservatives to believe that it is the natural-born duty of every publication to support Republicans. Well, let me be specific. Of papers endorsing a presidential candidate in 1968, 80% endorsed Nixon, which is about what it's been, with one exception, for Republican candidates in every presidential race in this generation. And it's not just the small-town papers. Endorsement by circulation size is about the same percentage. And if we're talking about a press out of step, how about 80% for Nixon while their readers vote 43.5% for Nixon? Now, let's assume that editorials are properly the boss's own turf, as I think properly they are, and that perhaps the reader can see other points of view in the political columns. We recall, of course, that the Vice President called for a balance of views. Well, two-thirds of the papers that regularly endorse Republican candidates also have a preponderance of conservative columnists. Then what about bias in the news? The Vice President and others have been saying that news is slanted and that it's regularly slanted against the Republicans. Wrong again. Several years ago, I looked at the published studies of bias in political reporting, published in places like Journalism Quarterly, Public Opinion Quarterly, and books that had been written on them. At that time, there were 84 such studies in the literature. Of these, 74 showed pro-Republican bias in the news in papers with pro-Republican editorial policies. So is it possible, nevertheless, that the conservative bias is simply a reflection of the American electorate? It is not. In the 1969-1970 House of Representatives, which was more conservative than the present one, there were 222 districts whose congressmen voted more than half the time with a congressional conservative coalition. Let's call these conservative districts. These 222 conservative districts had 430 conservative dailies and 88 liberal ones, an advantage of 5-1, although the voting for their candidates was far less than that ratio. There were 202 liberal districts, and these had 360 conservative papers and only 115 liberal ones, counting those endorsing Humphrey as liberal. So even in liberal districts, conservative dailies outnumbered liberal ones 3-1. The Vice President has concentrated his attack, so far as the printed media is concerned, on the Washington Post and the New York Times, And in a sense, they are properly targets because they have influence disproportionate to their size. But both papers are closer to the national pattern of voting in the House than is the average American daily. This also happens to support staffs capable of looking beyond official statements. Reporters, of course, are accused of being mostly liberal and democratic, and they probably are. Though if liberality extends to equal rights for women, the past history of the National Press Club isn't exactly government exhibit A. The political values of reporters do not reflect any conspiracy. They reflect those of the educational and occupational class that they are drawn from. And there is little help for that if we want educated, sophisticated journalists. The only thing that could change, perhaps, is to include larger number of blacks and Chicanos, which may not have the political effect the vice president had in mind. But regardless of reporters' personal politics and the undoubted existence of some slanting, American reporters are the most disciplined against bias in their news writing than journalists of any country I know of. Despite all of this, I invite anyone who wishes, including the people who do research for government speeches on the press, to take a drive of 200 miles anywhere in the country and pick up every local paper they can along the way, as I frequently do, and to compare the national news in them. They are remarkably uniform, and they are remarkably devoid of anything that is contrary to officialdom. The basic problem, of course, is that the government and the press have different functions, and sometimes both sides forget it. The White House has a coordinator of communications whose job is to orchestrate the information that comes out of government. We're told that the public information expenditures of government are twice as big as the combined news budgets of both wire services, all three networks, and the 10 biggest dailies in the country. Now, orchestrating that is a big job, and it must be disappointing to see some of it altered by other people, like journalists. In fact, the key may be the word orchestrate. I sometimes get the impression that some people in the administration see the press as a great orchestra, a collection of different instruments sitting in different places, but all supposed to be playing the same tune. On the other hand, we like to think of ourselves as a collection of brilliant, independent-minded balladeers who sing our own individualistic songs in our own time. Well, we aren't that way, unfortunately. Not enough brilliance, but worse, not enough individualism, and not enough different songs. We in the press are, in fact, much too orchestrated. Too many of us play the same tune at the same time and keep listening to each other to make sure we're in harmony. But contrary to what the country's being told, this tune is usually the one handed out by the governmental director of sheet music for the day. Any systematic study shows that what the government says is what something like 90% of news reports say, basically undiluted. But while we're not individualistic enough, we've still got some independence. When the United States Marine Band is playing Everything's Coming Up Roses, thank God there has always been someone in the journalistic crowd who's plunking his own little guitar at Secondhand Rose. And that's reassuring. When the time comes that Big Daddy, or his attorney general, wraps his baton on the National Communications music stand and gets us all playing beautiful music together, we will have failed. Thank you.
Ben Bardukian, the assistant managing editor of the Washington Post.
After the Bill and Ben show, the administration deserves a little friendly treatment from our panel, and so we present Fred W. Friendly in the cleanup position. When the history of the media's coverage of the Vietnam War is written for the final time, if that day ever comes, Mr. Friendly will be recorded as the one man who did not love Lucy. It was his outrage at being blacked out from covering the Fulbright hearings on the war so that I Love Lucy and other comedy reruns could return to the screens of America's wasteland
for the seventh time,
that caused Mr. Friendly to resign his job as president of CBS News in early 1966. Since then, he has been television advisor to the Ford Foundation, and brother, can you spare a dime, and Edward R. Murrow, professor of journalism at Columbia University. The latter title is one he richly deserves. It was the team of Friendly and Murrow, of course, which garnered some 35 major awards for the See It Now series and 40 more for the equally celebrated CBS reports. Their professional teamwork lasted from the year they met in 1948 until Mr. Murrow took over the U.S. Information Service helm in 1961. Their close friendship continued, of course, until Ed died in 1965. And now, Fred, some friendly observations, please, about the administration and the media.
Whenever I'm introduced, coupled with Murrow, I always remember the night that Ed was going to take the president of Alcoa, our sponsor, to pajama game, and at the last minute, I, as Ed put it, sent him to Korea. It was really his idea. And there I was taking Mr. Wilson to see pajama game. And as I went up to the box office, the man, I said, "You have four tickets." He said, "What name?" I said, "Murrow." And as he gave me the four tickets, he turned to his colleague in the box office and he said, "He sure looks lousy without his makeup on." As I've been, I think our trio here, you don't need to laugh quite that loud. We need an editor, the three of us, and as I listened to Mr. Murrow and Mr. Bandickian, I started crossing out sentences, and I'm left with little more than my name is. But I decided I'd have to read it to you anyhow. If you get bored or tired, let me know and I'll stop. There are hundreds of questions that have been coming up here, and I'm sure you'd like to get to that. But I spent a little time on this, and I'd like to say it at you. We, the press, may be a nuisance, but we are not a menace. And the way power is running to the president, it would be unwise to concentrate too much on weakening whatever influence we have left. James Reston said that in 1966 with the administrations of Kennedy and Johnson in mind. In 1972, the power of the presidency is at its zenith. Congress seems impotent to influence foreign policy, while the news media is so preoccupied defending themselves that they often neglect their fundamental obligation to act as a counterbalance to government. James Madison identified that obligation when he wrote in The Federalist, "In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, you must first enable the government to control the governed, and then in the next place, oblige it to control itself." Madison understood that a free and responsible press was essential to the maintenance of that working equilibrium. That is the meaning of the First Amendment, to protect the public from the ambitions of government. President Nixon seems to forget that when he unleashes his media marauders, Agnew, Buchanan, Klein, Shakespeare, and Whitehead, the White House Five, to mine the waters of journalism and to interdict crucial lines of American communication. In their short-term strategy of what is and has been good for their candidate, they seem to forget that it was the coverage of the Vietnam War that forced President Johnson out of the 1968 presidential race. Even now, President Nixon and his advisors may yet learn the value of interpretive journalism and a press corps capable of serious analysis as he attempts to steer his Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty through the Senate. Many of us are still haunted by the failure of Woodrow Wilson to guide his League of Nations treaty through the Senate. And we all remember how a fearful and indifferent press contributed to that tragedy. An administration more concerned with its stance and the stance it projects in Southeast Asia than its priorities at home flays away at the news media as if the picture of the account of that tragedy is of the cause. As if the denunciation of the New York Times and Anthony Lewis for running reports from Hanoi as being a, quote, conduit for enemy propaganda, of NBC News for showing a British doctor's film of the bomb damage at Haiphong, and of Jack Anderson's report about our Bangladesh policy would somehow make the public believe that the blame is in the newsroom and not the cabinet room. Unfortunately, the plan to mute the press by intimidation is probably working. It all began with Vice President Agnew's opening salvo in Des Moines 2.5 years ago. Since then, hardly a week has passed without some kind of chilling blast. It's not just Agnew talking about Brinkley or Cronkite or Wicker. It's Senator Dole and the Republican National Committee sheet Monday firing wildly at almost everything that moves on the journalistic horizon. They've even taken aim at running a critique of CBS's coverage of the latest Vietnam crisis, and then that cheap shot claiming that correspondent Dan Shore's wife is quietly serving as a member of a task force advising presidential hopeful Ed Muskie on national policies. Mrs. Shore, a professional in her own right, attended one task force meeting and never returned. But as Dan Shore, who is here, might say, what if she did? Monday has gone so far as to claim that James Reston's son was raising funds in support of draft deserters, as if that had something to do with Reston's journalism. Herb Klein has told network affiliates at an NAB convention, you fellas do an excellent job. Why do you rely on CBS News? Pat Buchanan went so far as to suggest in a recent interview with Elizabeth Drew that if the news media didn't straighten out and employ more conservative reporters, quote, they might find something done in the area of antitrust action. Obscene. Ironically, the public television air, which Mr. Buchanan used to outline his views, is under attack from another White House marksman, Clay T. Whitehead. Mr. Whitehead has made his fame by threatening to cut the appropriations of public broadcasting if they don't get out of the news and public affairs business, particularly on a national basis where, to quote Whitehead, the commercial networks do such a good job. The contradictions between Vice President Agnew's opinion about the performance of network television news and that of Mr. Whitehead speak for themselves. Mr. Whitehead's myth that the Ford Foundation and a certain former network has been forcing news and public affairs programs down the transmitters of public television stations was exploded recently by a poll that Congressman Clarence Brown conducted among 105 public television stations. The poll showed that a majority of the stations hoped that new money available for programming at the national level would be used for public affairs and news. Incidentally, this is a pretty good time to say that the journalistic standard set by Jim Carrion and his colleagues at Impact in their first 9 months is worth noting. If journalism is content under pressure, which is what I tell my students, Carrion and company have sure had it. From those in and out of government who would like to remove all public affairs from public broadcasting. Yet, the people at Impact have never permitted themselves to become rattled. But the wildest myth floated by the White House Five is the theory that the Nixon administration is somehow the victim of a bad press, particularly on the Vietnam issue and specifically on television. There is no magic formula or computer to analyze a good or a bad press, but it is so obvious that the scales are always weighted in favor of Hail to the Chief, the Spirit of 76 jet, which is on its way home, and the ubiquitous presidential seal, plus all that airtime, that even a news media which traditionally plays the role of the adversary with all administrations cannot come close to balancing that scale. Obviously, I can't prove it, but it seems to me that President Nixon is this year enjoying a media bonanza unequaled since Kennedy's first year and Johnson's first 100 days. The Nixon administration bad-mouthing its media coverage is like John Paul Getty denouncing money or the oil depletion allowance. In his first 18 months in office, President Nixon appeared on prime television time as many times as the combined appearances of President Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson in their first 18 months in office. During his first 40 months in office, prior to his Moscow trip, the president, President Nixon, has made 32 special appearances in prime time to only 24 by President Johnson in over 5 years, 10 by President Kennedy in under 3 years, and 23 by President Eisenhower in 8 years. These startling figures were prepared by Richard Salant of CBS News for a recent speech in which he concluded that the Nixon incumbency, representing less than one-sixth of the years since President Eisenhower's inaugural, has accounted for more than one-third of those special appearances of those presidents, and most of President Nixon's airtime has been in prime time. When the White House Five complain about news analysis piggybacking on presidential airtime, they ignore the obvious fact that the president is hitchhiking on high-rated entertainment programs. President Nixon's track record on news conferences seems to vary inversely with his prime speech record. As the Washington News Committee of the Associated Managing Editors Association reports, no live radio and TV press conferences have been held since June 1st, 1971. That is one solid year ago today. President's conversation with network correspondents have been valuable, although they vary with the skill and the aggressiveness of the viewer. Dan Rather probably did the best of those. Mr. President, I see you're within 10 minutes of 2 o'clock. Are you religious about getting your people out of here by 2 o'clock? Because I see all those questions accumulating, and I don't want to run you down. Would you like me to terminate this?
I think it'd be wise.
All right. I'll be glad to do it. I just would like to... Anybody who wants to read what I wrote, I'm sure can pick up a copy of it someplace. There are 2 points that I'd like to do very quickly. I love Bill Monroe. I tried to get Eric Severide to hire him once for CBS a long time ago. It didn't work, but I think that Bill still needs to do a little work on the First Amendment. The First Amendment, which we all believe in, is not some magic shield such as Athena gave to Perseus, which is to protect broadcast journalists all the time from any kind of accountability. They got a license, and the way that they pay for that license is not with money, but with responsibility. It is not the FCC that keeps the nightly news programs down to 20 minutes, 22 minutes of airtime when they should be an hour. It is not the FCC that kept all three commercial networks from doing the most important debate of the decade, Red China, at the United Nations last October, when all three commercial networks gave up the opportunity to do that, and only public television did it on PBS. You can't blame that, and you can't blame the absence of documentaries in prime time on a regular basis on the FCC. The straitjacket that the networks claim they wear is not made at the FCC. It is homemade. As for the hour... As for the hour nightly news program, which has to come, if you were around, and I know you were, the day of the Wallace shooting, after the Wallace story, there were 4 minutes and a half on basically each of the network, but I clocked CBS, 4.5 minutes for the rest of the news budget that day, including the escalation of the Vietnam War. We could have our news programs, they could have them, if the FCC would change its prime time rule of 2 years ago, which limited the amount of network time that the three major commercial networks were allowed. At that time, some of us, including Dean Birch, including me, suggested that news and public affairs be accepted. We have now had 1 year of that in the works, and all we've gotten is another recycling of Truth and Consequences and other electronic popcorn. And if the FCC, which is always talking about public service, and the networks are always talking about doing their best, if they'd all get together, after all, we've seen Mr. Brezhnev and Mr. Nixon make a deal, calculated risk, and say, we can all serve the country better. Let's have that one exception to the primetime rule, and let's permit CBS, NBC, ABC to do an hour of news at night. Maybe all of us could have a little lesson that the broadcasters know what their license says, and that all of us, including the FCC, know what the First Amendment really means. Thank you.